We're going to continue in Daniel chapter 7 tonight. We've looked over the series of beasts, creatures, animals that Daniel saw in his vision. We've compared them with Nebuchadnezzar's dream back in Daniel chapter 2, seeing correlations there. We've talked about how these four beings, these four animals, represented empires, great nations that were to come, beginning with Babylon in Daniel's own time. And he had this vision in the first year of King Belshazzar, which was toward the end of the Babylonian Empire. It was hadn't fallen yet, but it was very close to the time when it was going to fall. And then after that, the Persian Empire, after that, the Greek Empire, and after that, the Roman Empire. And as we've gone through these, last week we were talking about the Roman Empire. Daniel's vision of that was of a beast very powerful and very frightening, very terrifying. And it had large iron teeth and claws of bronze, according to the original description, and then a little bit of comment later on. And that tells us about both the mixed nature of that empire, how the Greek culture was very much a part of that Roman Empire. It crushed, it devoured, it trampled, and last week I talked a little bit about the havoc that the Romans left in many places, how they took the resources to feed Rome. Rome had a huge dependent culture there, a huge dependent society of the plebes, the lower class citizens who didn't really have work and so forth, and so, you know, bread and circuses and all that. And they devastated hordes of wildlife for their entertainment. They devastated forests for their ships and their buildings and so forth, and to keep the fires of Rome burning. They did a lot of just basically ecological damage, as well as overwhelming all of these nations. It had the beast had 10 horns. Back in chapter 2, it had 10 toes of iron mixed with clay. And then there was a little horn that uprooted 3 of the first horn with eyes like a man and boastful words, and the little horn in verse 21 of Daniel 7 attacked the saints. So last week I said I really couldn't pin down the 10 horns as far as 10 nations, but I thought about that and I decided I wanted to point up at least one possibility in interpreting the 10 horns that the beast had, that this cosmopolitan beast had that Daniel saw. The Roman Republic is dated to have begun about 509 BC. There had been a city of Rome, a kingdom before that. The Roman Republic began about 509 BC and was expansionist in its appetites and began growing there in Italy and then eventually into Greece and so forth. Julius Caesar, if you'll, you know, count with me, number one, the Roman Republic. This is the beginnings, the Roman Republic. Number two, Julius Caesar. Now there's a lot of history involved in Julius Caesar becoming the sole ruler of the Roman Republic, and how he initially defeated Pompey, defeated Mark Antony and Cleopatra, and he became the sole ruler of Rome. In 49 BC, he defied the orders of the Roman Senate and crossed the Rubicon, the river, bringing his army with him, which a general was not supposed to bring his army across the Rubicon. But he did that in order to seize power for himself. And Julius Caesar then reigned as the dictator in Rome for several years. He was succeeded by Augustus Caesar. That wasn't his original name, but that's the name that he took when he became Caesar. He was the first one declared emperor in 27 BC, who was succeeded by Tiberius Caesar in 14 AD, who was succeeded by Caligula in 37 AD, who was succeeded by Claudius in 41 AD, who was succeeded by Nero in 55 AD. And so how many stages of rule do we have here at this point? We've got 7, okay? 7 so far. And then when Nero died in 68 AD, when Nero died by suicide, or either that or somebody threw him off a roof, it's never been 100% agreed whether he killed himself or was assassinated. But Nero died in 68 AD, and there were plenty of people who were thoroughly fed up with him, and so it could have gone either way. But when Nero died, there were 3 men who tried to become emperor in his place. The first was Galba, and he was assassinated. The second was Otho, and he was assassinated. The third was Vitellius. And he was defeated in battle because Vespasian, who was in Judea at the time, the Jewish uprising had started in 66 AD. And Vespasian was general of the army that was invading Judea to settle the Jewish revolt. And he had loyal generals and troops in North Africa, Egypt, in Judea, in Syria. He had a lot of troops behind him. And so when they had the three emperors, 8, 9, 10, in that one year, in 68 AD, Vespasian rallied his forces, got the support of his fellow generals in the east, and marched on Rome, and left his son Titus in charge of the Roman army that was in Judea to finish the putting down the Jewish revolt. Okay, so Vespasian, I'm suggesting, is one possible interpretation of the little horn, because he is the first Roman general to become... See, Caesar brought his army across the Rubicon, and there was the threat of war. But Vespasian was the first one, and it was right after the three in that year, Galba, Otho, and Vitellius. And that's what the little horn was said to do, was he displaced three others, and he spoke boastful words. And so he became emperor in 69 AD, and that's after the ten, the previous ten that we had listed up there. He became emperor. And then what makes him a little even more interesting as a potential fulfillment of this idea that Daniel saw with the ten horns and the horn then that rose up and displaced three horns and spoke boastful words. And that little horn that spoke boastful words oppressed the saints of God. And there was a persecution under Nero. Peter and Paul both apparently died under Nero. But that was a pretty small persecution. There had been disruptions under Claudius, but that didn't turn into official Roman persecution. It wasn't until Vespasian became emperor that we began to have this sort of official suppression of both Judaism and Christianity. Okay? And his son Titus took up where he left off. They used the wealth of the Jewish temple to build great building projects in Rome, to restart the economy in Rome. The Colosseum in Rome was built with Jewish gold, gold that had been taken from the temple in Jerusalem. There was a dedicatory sign that attributed that to the great victories of Vespasian and Titus, but it was lost over the centuries, but has been recovered in very recent times. But at any rate, a lot of the great building projects in Rome during that period were built with the gold that was extracted from the Jerusalem temple and Jerusalem itself in the Roman conquest. And Domitian, the son of Vespasian, he was the last of the emperors of the apostolic era. You know what I mean by apostolic era? John is considered to have written the book of Revelation, the last book of the New Testament, in 96 AD during the reign of Vespasian. The New Testament closes with this. We have the three, Vespasian, his name was also Flavius, and these three are called the Flavian emperors, Vespasian and his two sons. And Titus was the first Roman emperor who ever was the heir of his own father. None of those other guys had succeeded their father as emperor, but Vespasian was succeeded by Titus and Domitian. Under Domitian, according to the ancient accounts, there was severe persecution of Christians. They were required by law to offer sacrifices to the Roman emperor, which of course Christians would refuse to do. On pain of death, they would refuse to do that. And that law stood for several years after the time of Domitian. But at any rate, this idea of the little horn that grew up and spoke boastful words may well have been a reference to Vespasian and the Flavian emperors who rose up after 10, you know, cycles of rulers there, the Republic being succeeded by Julius Caesar, being succeeded by Augustus and so forth, down to Vespasian. We can't really be sure about that, but that is at least one possible reading, I think, of Daniel's vision of the little horn that spoke boastful words and persecuted the saints. But what Rome did in a positive sense, and we talked about this briefly last week. In a positive sense, Rome brought the Jews of Africa, Asia, and Europe under one governing authority. After Alexander's conquest, there had been two governing authorities over the major locations of Jews. Jews in Egypt, there were a lot of Jews in Egypt, but they were under the Ptolemaic rulers, and Jews in Judea and Syria, but they were under the Seleucid rulers, two different rulers who were in conflict with each other for a couple of hundred years. Under Rome, these all came under one banner, under one heading. And so the Jews all over the world, the great population centers and all of the Greek-speaking world, was brought under one governing authority. I mentioned again last week that Rome borrowed Greek culture, including the Greek language, made that essentially the language of commerce all over the Mediterranean world. The Roman peace and Roman roads made travel and commerce all around the Mediterranean world safe and feasible. I personally have taken a few steps on the road that went between Jerusalem and And that place where they were going in Luke chapter 24, when Jesus met the two disciples, they were on their way to where? Emmaus. Okay, they were on their way to Emmaus. And that Roman road to Emmaus, a lot of it's covered over now, but that the cobblestones are still there. There are places where the cobblestones, you can still walk on the same road that Jesus and those disciples walked on that Sunday of his resurrection. Or if you take a ride from Jerusalem to Jericho, it's got blacktop pavement on it now, but under that blacktop pavement is a Roman cobblestone road that's been there for 2,000 years. So the Romans built great roads. They unified Europe. There was a, you know, the Pony Express and the railroads unified America, but the Roman roads unified Europe and Asia as they never had been before. It was a great system, which was very beneficial. These things were very beneficial for the spread of the gospel. This was a great time for the gospel to be preached. Romans 13:1, when Paul said, "Let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God." He wrote that when Nero was emperor, okay? Which would have been the seventh in that list that I was just putting up there as a potential interpretation of the ten. But he wrote that during the time when Nero was emperor. And he could see very clearly the benefits of having this unifying political authority. Even, you know, in Russia right now, they have a totalitarian government. They had a little brief period, a little brief experiment with democracy, and they did what was extremely predictable. They went right back into a totalitarian government. Why did they do that? Because they know what to expect. Because there's stability. Because they know how it works. And when they tried democracy, they didn't know what to expect. Everything was shaky and uncertain, and there was all this corruption and people vying for power. But when you got that guy Putin at the top, you know what to expect. And people like that. People like knowing what to expect. That's why kings, monarchs, and dictators have thrived in most nations over the millennia, over the many centuries.
What kind of government did you see Russia
had? Totalitarian. Putin is in charge. All the rest of it is just window dressing. He is in charge. The Secret Service, what their version of Secret Service answers to him. The police answer to him. The governors answer to him. I mean, they have a Politburo. They have a Congress of sorts, but it doesn't do anything that Putin doesn't want it to do. I mean, everything else is window dressing. He is in charge. And the people are, occasionally somebody says, "Oh, this isn't any good," but mostly the people want it that way. Otherwise, it wouldn't continue to be that way. And Paul, looking at the Roman Empire, he saw stability, he saw commerce, he saw communication, he saw law and order, and all those things are to be desired. Right? And so, whether you think the form of government is the best or not the best, if you've got law and order and peace and commerce, there's a lot to be said. There's a lot going for it. And say again?
Onions and leeks in Egypt,
yeah. The Israelites out of Egypt, a few weeks out of Egypt, and then a few years out of Egypt, and they're saying, "Boy, wasn't it great back in Egypt?" Because they knew what to expect. We don't know what to, well, we can expect manna, but we're done with that. And they weren't done with that for a long time yet. But yeah, because it's stable, it's predictable. And people will put up with a lot in those kind of circumstances. And Paul saw the benefit. The authority, the governing authority, is ordained by God. And so whether I like governing authority or don't like governing authority, I try and kind of take this perspective. It isn't about whether it pleases me. There are other purposes in play besides whether I personally like the people in Sacramento or the people in Washington, D.C. It isn't about whether I agree with them or not. That's not the point. And Paul saw the benefit of Roman rule. It was, in many ways, a great time, not just for the church, but a great time to be alive. In many ways, it was a great time in the history of the world. So, Daniel chapter 7, verses 9 and 10. Jody, read that out loud for me. Daniel 7, verses 9 and 10. Because this is a kind of an interlude in the middle of this business about the four creatures. Alright, I do want to notice, I didn't ever read it, but I do want to notice in verse 11, he says, I kept looking and the little horn was still, the horn was still doing boastful words and all that. So, I just want to know, in terms of time frame, even though I could look at what I see in verses 9 and 10 and think, well, this is judgment at the end of time. But, that's not really when this begins. Because this is still in the time frame of that little horn speaking boastful words, because that's in verse 9 or verse 8, and then it's again in verse 11. Still in the time frame of the Roman Empire that these things are being purported. All right. So thrones. He says thrones were set in place. What are thrones for? To rule. And what?
For kings to sit on.
But somebody this morning read from a portion of Revelation that mentioned 24 elders. Where were the elders? What did they have? Ben's not in here, so he can't answer that question. They were in heaven. But what did the 24 elders have around the throne of God that was in the center? They had thrones. Okay, the 24 elders had thrones, and then the throne of God was in the center. And if we go, and that's in chapter 4 of Revelation. And then if we go to chapter 20 of Revelation, it talks about thrones being given to those who had been beheaded for the sake of Christ and how they would rule together with him, reign together with him for 1,000 years. So thrones are not only for kings, but they are for people in authority. Jesus told his 12 disciples in Luke 22, this is the night of his betrayal. This is after the supper, but before they've gone out to the Mount of Olives. And he says to them in Luke 22, 28 through 30, you, his immediate circle of disciples, are those who have stood by me in my trials. And I confer on you a kingdom, just as my Father conferred one on me, so that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And then we have Revelation 4 and 4, the 24 thrones with the 24 elders, and Revelation 20 and 4, the thrones for those who have given their lives for Christ. Okay? And neither of those is after the judgment. Both of those are before the judgment. And so is this, before the judgment. Jesus says, my Father, I confer on you a kingdom. My Father has conferred a kingdom on me. He had been preaching, the kingdom of heaven is at hand, all through his ministry. And his kingdom was about to begin in earnest. He had told Peter in Matthew 16, 18, I will give you the keys of the kingdom. And Hades, the death in Hades will not prevail against it. Okay, against his church, as he went on to say. But I will give you the keys of the kingdom. Well, when did Peter use the keys of the kingdom? Well, it was on the day of Pentecost, 7 weeks after he said this, plus a few days, on that first day of the week, the day of Pentecost, when the Holy Spirit came down, that Peter stood in front of that crowd of Jewish followers of God and proclaimed the gospel to them and told them how to be saved. Told them what they needed to do in order to be saved. So, I confer on you a kingdom. Yeah, it happened 7 weeks and 4 days after he said this to them that night. And you will sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And that kind of judgment, it was traditional in ancient times. And we can find numerous scriptures that speak to this. But in a small town that didn't have a king, You would have the elders of the town sitting in the town gate, judging matters that were brought before them. In a town like Jerusalem, the king himself and his counselors would sit in the gate and judge matters that were brought before them. When you read about Solomon judging the two prostitutes that came and, you know, my baby died, no, her baby died, no, you know, that whole thing. And that was almost certainly, that would have been in the city gate at Jerusalem. It wouldn't have been in some palace. It would have been in the city gate, because that's where matters were brought to the king for judgment, was in the gate. And this was an ongoing thing that not only kings, but city rulers, elders, that they engaged in. So when Jesus said, you'll sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel, that didn't convey to them the idea, oh, we'll be kings. It conveyed to them this idea of we'll have authority in the city of God. We will help decide matters and settle issues in the city of God. Places of great honor, yes, but not necessarily the idea of sitting and reigning on thrones. But thrones were set in place. This is part of the church idea. Thrones set in place. The 24 elders in heaven, the 12 apostles in their role in the apostolic era, and the dispersing of the doctrine of Christ. Daniel says in chapter 7, verses 13 and 14, oh, and by the way, in the 9th and 10th verses, we're going to look at this a little bit more very shortly here, but the Ancient of Days took his seat. Who would the Ancient of Days be? God, sure. Now, a little later on, it sounds like the Lord Jesus, but that's okay, because in Revelation chapter 1, I am the Alpha and the Omega. It's clearly the Father who's speaking. But in Revelation 22, I am the Alpha and the Omega. It's clearly Jesus who is speaking. Okay? So that's okay. We can think of Jesus, but it is, yes, it's God. And particularly here, we think in terms of the Father taking his seat on his throne. The Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was white as snow. The hair of his head was pure like what pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. We're going to look at a few other verses that speak to those ideas, and a river of fire flowing out from the throne, coming out from before him. And we're going to look at this, but in Revelation 22, it speaks of something flowing out from the throne of God. But what is it that flows out from the throne of God? The pure river of the water of life. Yeah. Now, what's the difference between a river of fire and a river of water? Water of life. Yeah, one destroys and the other innervates. One brings life, one brings death. One is judgment, one is blessing. Well, which is it? Is God the God of a consuming fire or the God of life? Yeah, both of those. Judgment proceeds from the throne of God. And I assure you, people like to think that everybody can go to heaven, but a great many people would not be happy at all in heaven. They would be just as miserable in the presence of the consuming fire that is God as they will be out of the presence of God in the lake of fire, because their sins have not been redeemed. They haven't wanted to prepare themselves for the heavenly experience. So this is something to bear in mind, that the river of life versus the river of fire, it's not actually flip sides of the same coin. It is the same thing depending on who you are. Whether you are given light and purification in the presence of God, or whether you find condemnation and rejection because you have rejected him. It depends on who you are. All right. So going on, notice in Daniel 7:14, in connection with what we were just reading, in verses 13 and 14, Daniel says, in my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man. Well, Ben talked about this morning too. In the Gospel of Luke especially, how does Jesus refer to himself over and over and over again? He is the Son of Man. Okay, the Son of Man came to seek and save what is lost. That's one of the offices of Jesus. He is the descendant of Adam. His genealogy in Luke chapter 3 goes all the way back to the Son of Adam, the Son of God. Okay, he is human. One like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days, the Father in other words, and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. This same throne scene is presented to us in the fifth chapter of Revelation, when the one on the throne has in hand a scroll sealed with seven seals. And the question is asked, who is worthy to open the scroll? And they looked, and there was no one in heaven or earth, and John despaired. And when he began to cry, the angel said to him, don't worry. The lion, and Ben talked about this morning too, the lion of the tribe of Judah has triumphed. And so then what John saw was one that looked like a lamb that had been slain standing in the middle of the throne. The lion of the tribe of Judah looked like a sacrificed lamb. And he took the scroll from the hand of him who was seated on the throne. He appeared in the midst of the throne, took the scroll from the hand of him who was seated on the throne. When Daniel saw it, he saw one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven, coming before the throne of the Ancient of Days. And all people, all nations worshipped him. And that's described also in the fifth chapter of Revelation, because this is an overview. Some people choose to worship him here and now. But all people in all time are going to bow before him. Paul says that in Philippians, the second chapter, unto him every knee will bow, every tongue will confess that Jesus is Lord to the glory of God the Father. Everyone will acknowledge the authority of Jesus that he received when he was glorified to the right hand of God. And Jesus had said to his disciples in Matthew 16:28, I tell you the truth, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. I do not suppose that anyone who was standing there that day is still walking around today. They're gone. But they live to see the kingdom. That's what Jesus said. Some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. So that coming before the clouds, the coming in the clouds, coming before the throne of the Almighty, the coming of the kingdom, the using of the keys, there were men standing there that day who lived to see it. Now there were also some standing there that day who didn't live to see it. Judas was one. He didn't live to see it. There may have been others, but Judas was one, and Jesus was another who would die before this happened. He would also be raised from the dead, but he did taste death before the coming of the kingdom. So there was this separation. Some of them there died. Judas and Jesus both died. And some of them there would not die until they saw the kingdom come. And we had that verse in Luke 22:29 where Jesus said to his disciples, I confer on you a kingdom. So in 7:9, we have the Ancient of Days, that's God. We have the white clothing and hair. We can look at Revelation chapter 1. Jesus is described in that same way. He looks like a son of man, but he also is radiant like the sun. He is brilliant white. He has this same kind of glory that's described here. We have the fiery throne, and this is what Ezekiel described as the throne of God in Ezekiel chapters 1 and 2. What Eric von Däniken thought was a UFO. This fiery chariot that Ezekiel saw, the throne of God blazing with fire, carried by cherubim with the wheels of fire that turned in whatever direction the chariot needed to go, but borne by the cherubim. The fiery throne of God. And we have various other references to the fire that came down on Mount Sinai when God presented himself on Mount Sinai. Or in 2 Thessalonians 1:7, the fiery splendor of the second coming of the Lord Jesus Christ. We have reference to a river of fire, and in Isaiah 30, verses 27-28, Isaiah talked about this fire that would flow out from God and in judgment of his enemies, that his enemies would be burned up. And that's actually referenced at the end of Isaiah when it talks about the heavenly Jerusalem as well, the fiery destruction of the enemies of God. And Revelation 22, 1 and 2, where it talks about from the throne of God flows this river of the water of life. The river of the water of life that flows out from the throne of God, an image that we are certainly more comfortable with than the image of the river of fire. And books were opened. And books were opened. That also is mentioned in the scene of judgment in Revelation 20, 11 through 15. But Jesus said in John chapter 5, he said that the Father had entrusted judgment to the Son. And then he said, but I don't judge anyone. It's my words that will judge you. My words will judge you. And so books are opened. People are judged on the basis of what the Lord has revealed, of what God has said, and the basis of what we do and what we say in response to what God has said and done. Books were opened. This is nothing arbitrary about this. This is according to the reality of what God has done and what human beings have done. Continuing on here in the midst of this, we have verses 11 and 12, where Daniel says, I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words that the little horn that grew big was speaking. I kept looking, and the beast was slain, and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire, thrown into the lake of fire. This also is referenced in the book of Revelation in regard to the false prophet and the other one. Can't think what the other one is. The beast and the false prophet, and then to Satan himself being cast into the lake of fire. The beast in Revelation chapter 13 is the Roman Empire, which is also what it is right here. The beast out of the sea in Revelation is the Roman Empire. The beast was slain and thrown into the lake of fire. The other beasts had been stripped of power but remained. As, for example, the Greek language continued on for hundreds of years after that as the language of the Mediterranean world and so forth. But their influence, and Rome in Revelation is referred to repeatedly as Babylon, because the spirit of Babylon lives on in Rome. We have persecution, deliverance, and judgment described here. The Roman Empire, and especially the little horn that grew big and boastful. In verse 18, we have reference to persecution. The saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom, possess the kingdom for all ages to come. Verses 21 and 22, we have the saints being given the kingdom. The ancient race came, judgment. The horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the highest, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. So there's persecution, but there's also deliverance and judgment. And this is a kind of an overview of the Roman period and then the succession in the so-called Holy Roman Empire, when either you towed the line with the official doctrine out of Rome, or you were anathematized, you were cast out, or you were put to death, especially during the Inquisitions of the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, when it was death to defy the authority of Rome.
Latin and Greek.
Yeah. Latin is the native language of the Roman people, and it's spoken in Rome during that period of time. And eventually, it became sort of the cerebral language of the Western Roman Empire. From the 4th century on, the Roman Empire was largely split into two parts. The Western part, although Rome was really no longer the pivot of that because it had fallen into degradation, and Constantinople. Right. In 312, when Constantine became emperor, he established a new Roman headquarters in Turkey, Constantinople. And Istanbul, not Constantinople, right? That was a song, you know. But it was called Constantinople until the 19th century. It was only in the very recent history that its name was changed. Named after Constantine, sometimes called the Great, who became emperor in 312. But his empire was not in Rome. And the eastern part of the empire continued to be Greek, continued to speak Greek right up until, you know, modern times. The Bible of the Greek Orthodox Church is the Greek Bible. The same Greek Bible that these folks were using 1700 years ago. But the Roman Empire in the West, from about 400 on, a man named Jerome translated the Bible into the vernacular, that is the Roman common language, which was Latin. It's called the Vulgate because it was in the vulgar language, the everyday language of the Latin-speaking people of that side of the Roman Empire. But the Greek dominated until the end of the 4th century. And then in the West, Latin became the language of the educated. Okay. It wasn't the language of the common man. The priest in the pulpit who was trained to read Latin and to speak Latin in the masses, the man in the pew didn't understand what he was saying, by and large. But they kept doing it for centuries. Yeah. Up until 1962, when Vatican II said, no, you don't have to do that anymore. And some still do it. Mel Gibson still has Latin right in his church, because he's that kind of a Catholic, but yeah, two completely different languages, not even closely related to each other at all. Latin is closely related to Spanish and French, the so-called Romance language, because from out of Rome, Latin is the predecessor of French and Spanish. Not of German. German is from a different root, and not of Greek. Greek is from a different family root. But two different languages, very different languages. But even though Rome was the imperial power, Greek was the language of Egypt, Syria, Turkey, Asia Minor, you know, all of that area over into the isthmus, the Greek peninsula there, you know. And consequently, Greek would take you pretty much anywhere. You could pretty much go anywhere if you spoke Greek and find somebody to order dinner or buy a house or whatever you wanted to do. So Jesus, in Matthew 16, asked his disciples, who do you say the Son of Man is? Or who do people say the Son of Man is? And this is, of course, something repeated over and over again. And Peter answers in verse 16, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And then Jesus goes on to say, and you're Peter, and, you know, I'll give you the keys of the kingdom, all that. But who is the Son of Man? He is the Christ, the Anointed One, the Son of the living God. In Matthew 26, and this is where we're going to have to stop tonight and pick this up again in 2 weeks. I was hoping to finish Daniel 7 tonight, but I'm just too verbose. In Matthew chapter 26, when Jesus was standing before the high priest on trial, and they wanted any excuse to condemn him, he would not answer a word. He would not answer a word. And so the high priest, and it was an illegal assembly anyway, but the high priest said to him, I charge you under oath. I adjure you by the living God. I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. And the Old Testament, the law said that a Jew had to answer a question that was posed in that way, in the name of God. They had to answer a question of that nature. And so Jesus told him the truth. Yes, it is as you say, Jesus replied. But I say to all of you, which was basically to the Sanhedrin, the chief priests of Sanhedrin, I say to all of you, in the future you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. Now what's he referring to when he says that? He's referring to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7, when we saw the Ancient of Days take his seat, and we saw one like a Son of Man coming before him on the clouds of heaven. That's what Jesus is referring to. And the high priest absolutely understood. Because if you just look at what Jesus said, it's all a little bit convoluted language, isn't it? I mean, if you don't know what he's talking about, you'll see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One coming on the clouds of heaven. And the high priest took that as sufficient. Okay, that's enough blasphemy. We can condemn him for that. The high priest tore his clothes and said, he has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. Because what was he saying? Well, he was saying, I'm going to be glorified at the right hand of God. I'm going to reign on the throne. He is taking that prophecy in Daniel of the Son of Man and applying it to himself. And they understood the Son of Man here was a divine being. They understood that. They didn't have to have that explained to them. They understood that this was about a divine being coming in the presence of the Father. And so they accused him of blasphemy. They condemned him to death. They took him to Pilate to demand that he be put to death. Or in Acts chapter 1, verses 9 through 11, when Luke reports the ascension of Jesus into heaven, they were out there on the slope of the Mount of Olives, and they were talking with Jesus. And after he told them, stay in Jerusalem until you receive power from on high. You'll be baptized with the Holy Spirit before many days pass, 10 days it would be. But after he had said this, he was taken up before their eyes, and a cloud hid him from their sight. And again, we're being reminded of Daniel's prophecy. A cloud hid him from their sight. He was taken up into the clouds. And they were looking intently up into the sky as he was going, when suddenly two men dressed in white stood beside them. Angels, in other words. Men of Galilee, they said, why do you stand here looking into the sky? The same Jesus who's been taken from you into heaven will come back in the same way. And this is what John says in Revelation chapter 1. He will be in the clouds, and every eye will see him. He will come back in the same way that you have seen him go into heaven. We'll stop there for tonight.
Can you help me
There's not a single scripture that says he will set foot on the earth. We will be caught up together to meet him in the air. That's what it says. That's in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. We who are alive and remain will be caught up together with him and meet him in the air, and so shall we ever be with the Lord. Yeah. There is no scripture, no prophecy that says Jesus will ever set foot on earth again. There are plenty of them that speak of the fiery conflagration that will consume the elements when what can be consumed is consumed, when what can be removed or shaken is removed. But no, Jesus will take us. I go to prepare a place for you. And if he goes to prepare a place for us, I'll come again and bring you unto myself. There in John chapter 14. So. There are people who believe that, but they don't get it out of the scriptures. Peter is very emphatic in the third chapter, 2 Peter, that the world would be burned up, consumed. And the entirety of the cosmos is described as being rolled up like a scroll, which modern physics actually fits okay with that. But our very limited understanding of the nature of the cosmos, but fits very well with that. Okay, we're going to stop there. Next week we'll have potluck. 2 weeks, we'll finish Daniel 7, continue on into Daniel chapter 8. We're going to go a little more quickly through 8, 9, 10, 11. Well, we're going to go a little more quickly through 8, 9, 10, and 11 and try and finish those up during the months of November and December. And Joshua is the one who will be on for the class, but he and I are going to work that out. So, although someone else may have to fill in the second Sunday of December, we'll see how that goes. If he has to work. Hopefully he won't have to work any Sundays. The time has come for us to have a closing song. It's a song of invitation as well as the conclusion of our meeting tonight. There's an open invitation if anyone among us needs to come before the church, whether to profess faith in Jesus and repentance from sins in order to be baptized into Jesus, become a part of his body and a part of his family. Or if there is anyone among us who needs the prayers of the church and this is the time and place to make it known, we invite you to come forward while we sing together. Chuck?